Welcome everybody again to another episode of Need Some Introduction. In today's episode, I'll be breaking down the season finale of Shogun, the very successful FX series adapted from the 1975 James Clavell novel, which just wrapped up today. I'll also be giving you a couple of recommendations related to the Edo period of Japanese history, which kicks off right after the events of this series. And through that recap, I will be discussing some of the highlights of this really excellent series of television. And then stay tuned at the end. I will also be correlating the events of the series to historical events, the historical figures that these events are based upon. And in my discovery and exploration of those historical figures, I did find that there's even some more resonance, some hidden meaning of some of the events here in the series, either intentional or not. But I do think it adds some interesting shading to the character and the history revealed in this series. But before I get to some of the historical parallels, I want to get into the actual events of this particular season finale. So before the recap, recommendation number one is for a Japanese film called Harakiri from 1962. This, by the way, is not only one of the most well-respected samurai films of all times, and I know it's old, but if you like Akira Kurosawa movies, by the way, even older than this film, you should definitely track it down. It's streaming on the Criterion Channel, and of course rentable as well. I think there's an unsubtitled version of the film available on YouTube, so do that as you will. And this film is an interesting drama with elements of a thriller, and its timeline begins in 1619, which, if you've noticed in Shogun, we're ending the series in 1603, the beginning of the Edo period of Japanese history. So an interesting film to watch immediately after the events of Shogun. And in the story, a ronin, which at the time was simply a samurai without a home after the fall of these clans, shows up in the manor house of his local feudal lord and wants to commit ritual suicide, thus the title of the film. And over the course of the ensuing time period of the film, starts to reveal his story, why he wants to commit this act. And through telling his backstory, it reveals and deglamorizes this history, the mythology of the samurai. And there are many betrayals and family secrets that are revealed that implicate and shame some of the other lords in the area. So it's a really fascinating story, very well told, beautifully shot in black and white, and an interesting deconstruction of this mythology of the samurai. Something that is an interesting counterpoint to some extent that the Shogun series arguably glamorizes this mythology in a way that this film is a counterpoint to. Although the 1962 version is the better version of this story, the same story is retold in the 2011 film Harakiri, Death of a Samurai. This was originally shot in 3D. I did not see it in 3D. It's not available to watch at home in 3D. However, it's very easy to stream. It's available on Tubi, Freebie, Pluto. Beautifully photographed with a tone almost of a horror film. This film is directed by Takashi Miike, who's most famous in the US for his breakthrough film Audition from 1999. 1999, a very relevant film year in the recent podcast episodes. And this was his follow-up to another samurai film he made, 13 Assassins, which was a huge international success. Less so for this film, but this still got a lot of respect, won a lot of awards. And as I mentioned, without any other context, an excellent film, an excellent retelling of the same story. But the 62 version is the better version. As a matter of fact, if you follow me on Letterboxd or just go to the Letterboxd lists, that 1962 film is the highest rated film to this day on Letterboxd. So that's how well respected that is, and even current audiences embracing that film. But if you don't like seeing a film in black and white, if you don't like seeing an old film, and it is relatively hard to find, only available on Criterion, you can track this remake down from 2011, very easily available on almost all the fast streaming services. And that one is called Harakiri as well, with the additional Death of a Samurai title. Now for my next pick, we're going to jump all the way back to 1961 for the film Yojimbo, an all-time classic directed by Akira Kurosawa. And this is also in the Edo period of Japanese history, but at the end of this, the 200-year, more than 200-year period of Japanese history, once again deconstructing the supposed peace and tranquility that that period represented, we have yet another ronin roaming the countryside who rolls into a town and is recruited by two criminal gangs as a weapon against each other. And Tashiri Mifune, who plays this ronin, almost wordlessly just allows them to destroy each other, and he becomes this this ambiguous figure that just allows things to happen, taking very little action, but always pushing things so the luck always lands in his direction. This, of course, was remade as A Fistful of Dollars. It has a sequel, as does A Fistful of Dollars, based on the follow-up film. And back in the day, this was a massively successful film, even internationally, which led to the English language remakes. And in the same way that those spaghetti westerns recontextualized some of the mythology of the Old West, Kurosawa and some of these other samurai films from the 60s both reinforced and simultaneously deconstructed some of the samurai mythology and the Edo period in Japan. As I mentioned, Toshiro Mifune is the star of this film and, by the way, played Yoshi Torinaga in the 1980 version of Shogun. I do not believe the 1980 version of Shogun is available to stream currently, although I'm sure it will pop up given the success of the new series. But just a moment spent on discussing that series as well. A massive success back in 1980. About a quarter of the American population watched that miniseries and helped kick off the fixation in the United States with Japanese culture. Sushi restaurants started popping up everywhere. There was a real fear of the growing Japanese influence around the world and their wealth, and simultaneously a real fascination with the culture of the country. And that was our Torinaga back then. And our Torinaga today is played by Hiroyuki Sanada. And that's my last recommendation here. Twilight Samurai, starring Hiroyuki Sanada. This one back from 2003. Not available to stream anywhere, but rentable in all your usual places. And this also takes place at the very end of the Edo period in Japan, and tells this really emotional and touching story of this fading samurai who's trying to provide a life for his daughters. He's been widowed and trying to regain his honor to some extent, and wrestling with this legacy of his perhaps wasted life and trying to leave a good example for his daughters. And a very small scale samurai story, really surprising, with an incredible central performance. So do check that one out as well. The Twilight Samurai from 2002. Episode 10 of Shogun is called A Dream of a Dream. This references episode 2, in which in flashback we see the Taiko dying 1 year earlier to the events of the series. And he says, "Oh life, how strange, a dream of a dream." And of course, this is all occurring in the immediate wake of the events of episode 9, an extraordinary episode of television, which is maybe the highlight of the entire season of the show, in which Mariko faces her destiny and dies for her cause. Now, death has been stalking her throughout this entire season. If we go all the way back to episode number 1, she comes to comfort Fuji when Fuji's confronted with the fact that her husband and child, newborn child, were going to be sacrificed because of his act of dishonor. And she tells Fuji, "I know you feel the pull of death. I have felt it too." And over the course of this series, we see that she's been waiting for death, basically. She has been dealing with this pain. Her family was executed because of her father's treacherous acts, which may have been actually honorable, but obviously any act against the Lord in power would be seen as dishonorable. She was the only one who was spared, and she's been living with this shame and the pain of this for her whole entire life, but has not been allowed to die. She had asked her abusive husband, Buntaro, to put her out of her misery multiple times, and he had always denied her and had been physically abusive to her as well. And tragically, in episode 8, when he tried to make amends with this tea ceremony, had basically offered to put her out of her misery so that they could die together. He was also feeling the shame, having just been the second for his father's seppuku. And in a really incredible scene in the series, she tells him, "I have wanted to die to get away from you. I do not want to die with you," more or less. I'm paraphrasing. And in episode 9, immediately in the wake of that episode, she has returned to Osaka under the pretense that she is delivering Torinaga's plans to surrender, but then needs to return to her master while he continues to mourn his son's death. And all of this is a ruse to reveal to the lords and ladies staying in the castle that they are all actually hostages to Lord Ishido. When she plans to leave, she is stopped. This is a very interesting catch-22, and believe it or not, this is the actual Crimson Sky strategy. It's not a giant battle of flaming arrows, as previously outlined. It is simply revealing to everybody what is in the back of their minds and in plain sight. And by her simply forcing the issue and not being allowed to leave, she puts Ishido in an impossible situation. To keep her from leaving or kill her would be an affront to all these great families that are currently trapped within. To let her go simply allows them to leave, and then he'll have no leverage anymore because these families will no longer be his captives. And in a drawn-out sequence of just trying to exit the grounds of the castle itself, Mariko is not killed, but many of her men are, and she's not allowed to leave. In dishonor, her next attempt at suicide here is to explicitly say that she would commit seppuku the following evening. And once again, if Ishido allows this to happen, he would be disgraced, since she is from an honorable family, regardless of her father's acts. She's also considered extremely honorable and is held in high esteem by all of these families. The night of her ritual suicide, none of the other lords come to be her second. And this is a variation from the book, by the way, just to call it out here. Yabu is the person who steps up in the novel to be her second before the suicide is interrupted. In the TV adaptation, we see Blackthorn stand by her in this moment, and it's incredibly powerful. What a smart decision here in an adaptation. This is something that, in his mind, is anathema that someone would kill themselves for honor, for reputation, when he is someone with no reputation, who is a pirate that has scoured the world to make his own destiny. And even though he completely disagrees with her, that in this moment, he has already asked her to live for him, and she has denied that. And yet, he stands here with her, and it's wildly romantic for such a dark moment, but yes, really a beautiful scene. And of course, the act is interrupted, and she feels this reprieve as a weight off her shoulders, although she is ready at that moment to do the honorable thing and once again fulfill her mission of showing the chink in Ishido's armor. And that night, she and Blackthorn pillow once again, and incredible chemistry between the two actors, and really the heart of this series, partially what really makes it so compelling. So one more attempt here. Ishido sends in some assassins with the assistance of the turncoat Yabu. I was really surprised by this, by the way. I really felt like the show was trying to parallel him and John. And maybe that's the point here, is to see these two divergent paths that could have been John's path. But because of his love for Mariko, he makes different decisions. These ninjas show up. Interestingly, we see them killing all the servants, but preserving the noble people. And their plan is to simply capture and imprison Mariko. But as they're about to detonate the door to break into their hiding area, she sacrifices herself, presses herself against the door, partially blocking the blast, so helping the people within, so it's an honorable death in that way, and simultaneously by dying in the name of her family, sets off the domino effect that plays out in this particular episode of TV. And Ishido has to eventually let the regents and their families leave. Another notable change from the book to this series is the death of Toda Hiramatsu. To convince everybody that Torinaga is truly broken and defeated, he tells the men still loyal to fight that they are to surrender to Ishido. And Toda Hiramatsu, his best friend, commits seppuku and is seconded by Buntaro. In the novel, this is just some other general who commits suicide. By having it be Hiramatsu, not only is there this additional heft and conviction that Torinaga is really surrendering, but adds a real emotional heft to that sequence, one of the strongest sequences in this, in a really strong episode of the series. As episode 10 begins, we see Blackthorn on his deathbed in England, presumably, with grandchildren about. An interesting way to start the episode. It sets this context that he does return to England eventually, which on the one hand does not pay off well in the structure of the episode, but I see what they're trying to do is to simply take away his fate. It's not like he's going to die. That's not what we're going to see in this episode. It allows us to focus on other aspects of the story and, more importantly, other themes within the episode itself or the series itself. Cosmo Jarvis looks absolutely terrifying, by the way, has very intense light eyes and especially terrifying looking in his old age makeup. We flash back to moments after the explosion. Mariko has died. Blackthorn is a broken man. Multiple times within this episode seems to have lost this stubborn single-mindedness to elevate his own name, something that is so culturally dichotomous with the philosophy of the other characters within this series. And that is represented just a couple episodes back when he is at the Zen garden and we see all the perfectly groomed sand, all the furrows, all traveling in the same direction, something that is replicated in this really beautiful opening sequence, the title sequence of the series itself. And he presses his forearm to cut a line against all of those streams. And that is him trying to cut through this preordained flow, this very different cultural perspective that he is being swept up in. And at this moment, it really seems like he is broken. He no longer sees his fate in his own hands. Yabu is also distraught over the death of Mariko. He had expected her to be captured, but the death has come as a blow to him as well. Meanwhile, we see Toronada meditating out somewhere with his trusty hunting falcon nearby. He eventually releases the falcon to be free again. This, of course, is the metaphor for Mariko as well. The first time we see him in the very show, not only the first time we see the falcon, but the first time we see Toranaga at all, he is hunting. And he says about the bird, how impressive she is, that she hides in the sun, waiting for her moment to strike. And we've also seen this philosophy play out that he knows how to manipulate people simply by observing them, by understanding their wants and their desires. He can get them to do what he wants them to do. And he understands how to manipulate the different birds that he has, that he's trained to hunt. Some birds go for the easy prize. Some birds hide until they're ready to strike. Some use force, some use stealth. And he, as a strategist, uses the people the way they want to be used, in a way. And that's what happened with Mariko, who wanted to die this whole entire time. And he's been making her wait and making her wait until that death had the most meaning possible to her, potentially, but definitely to him. And as she is now gone, he lets the falcon go as well. Ishido attempts to convince the regents that the attack came from Toranaga. The Catholic regents within the group want a Christian burial. And Ishido says, why should she get what she wants? After all, her father was the murderer of Lady Ochiba. But she herself speaks up, also very moved by Mariko's sacrifice. And of course, they had conversed as well. They had known each other their whole entire lives. And in one of their last interactions, she had started to move Lady Ochiba back into support for Toranaga. And that begins here by her allowing this Christian funeral. With that, the floodgates open. The families begin to leave the castle. And Ishido sees that his power is slipping. Yabu is also losing his mind here, shell-shocked and experiencing guilt for his actions. Blackthorn has been in and out of consciousness, has actually slept for days at some point, missed the funeral, and is to be escorted, supposedly back to his ship. Walking through the woods, Blackthorn is especially antagonistic, and he says, I know I'm going to be killed out here anyway, but discovers that actually Mariko had negotiated for his safe passage. However, there was a sacrifice. His ship had been sunk. When Blackthorn and Yabu return to the village, Omi is there and already knows of his betrayal, and Toranaga wants to see him. Yabu agrees to commit suicide, but asks for Toranaga to be his second, which he agrees to. He also offers Omi to be his heir and offers him the city of Izu. Toranaga mentions to him that he no longer has a fief given his betrayal, so he has no land to give. Nonetheless, Omi is moved by him being called his heir. Blackthorn returns home and is met by Fuji, and Mariko's absence is movingly just hinted at when he says no translator, and they both feel her loss in more ways than one. Toranaga meets his baby. This was one of the excuses provided before for him to not return, that he had not spent time with his infant son yet. And he does indeed have an infant son, totally unknown to me until this moment in the show. And his wife provides a note that was given to her from Lady Ochiba, which of course is the culmination of his plot this whole entire time, to use Mariko to not only show to the captives within the castle Ishido's true nature, but to bring Lady Ochiba back to their side. And to this, Toranaga quotes Mariko, what a bonfire her poems would make. Indeed, what a bonfire she has made with her actions. The next morning, Blackthorn goes to see Toranaga, and Toranaga's spy translates, and Blackthorn starts to understand some of Toranaga's grand scheming just in the biography of this one man who was a samurai, but had gone and become a fisherman in this village to be a spy for Toranaga. But he wasn't one thing or the other. He was both things. And he explains how he is now not only a spy, but is truly a Christian, but is also loyal to Toranaga. He does not see a conflict between these two aspects of himself. And we'll get into the historical corollary to Blackthorne, but perhaps Blackthorne now is not only the Protestant agent that he was when he arrived, he is now truly Japanese as well. He is Anjin. He is both. He does, however, disagree with the rough way that these supposed spies who burned his ship are being treated in the village. He does no longer wants these acts committed against the fishermen. And it's revealed here that Torinaga had discussed with Mariko the whole entire plan, that they would spare Blackthorne, burn the ship, and that he even participated in this plan by burning the ship. And yet he allows this to continue. This is an interesting moment in defining Torinaga's character. His dream, he reveals, has always been to be shogun, which we always knew. Every time someone said that, he's like, I don't want it. I don't want it. Like Jon Snow, I don't want it. But unlike Jon Snow, he really did want it. And just for appearances, just to play out that this was an act of sabotage, that he was not behest to, he will allow these people, innocent people, to die. Because it's all for the greater good, for this vision of this peaceful era that will dawn with his reign. This is a little bit of a blow to Blackthorne as well. Blackthorne actually wants to die at this point. He's depressed, having lost Mariko. He's lost the fire of this fight against the Portuguese. He no longer feels like he is in control of his own fate. He probably feels like a leaf on the wind at this point. As Yabu comes to see Torinaga in his final moments, he has his last will. He's been rewriting his will over and over again. Impending death in almost every episode, or at least the earlier episodes of the series. Very entertainingly, now he has truly his last will. And interestingly, someone he's been so fixated on death this whole entire time and how different people die. He wanted a spectacular death. He wanted to be shot with a cannon at one point earlier in this episode. But he gets the same death that most of these men do. But he does not want to be burned. He does not want to be buried. He wants to be left in a field to be eaten by dogs. Torinaga speaks mostly the truth here to Yabu in his final moments. He talks to him about Blackthorne. He admits the fact that he is complicit in the destruction of the ship. And he says, if he ever rebuilds it, I might destroy it yet again. And that it may not be his destiny to ever leave Japan, which, spoiler for history, by the way, once again, stay tuned. I'll have you have many historical points here to discuss here at the very end. The real life Blackthorne corollary never did leave Japan again. In the context of the show, however, we do know that he does leave Japan at some point because we see him as an old man back in England, presumably anyway. He also reveals that in a month or so, a war will begin and Ishida will show up in battle, very confident that the heir's army, the Imperial Army, will be at his back. And it will be revealed that Lady Ochiba, and therefore the heir, will not be there. And they won't take a side. They simply won't fight. But when Ishido's outnumbered in the field, the other regents will turn on him, and Torinaga will be victorious. And this is what we get, the only hint we get of the conclusion of the novel itself, where Torinaga does indeed win. Ishido is buried up to his neck and left to die. And then this is where we get to a critique, perhaps, of the glamorization of the actions in this series. Torinaga tells Yabu that Blackthorne was allowed to live mostly because he kept him entertained. He found him funny. And more truthfully, it was a distraction to his enemies. So confusing his enemies was important to him as well, and it worked. But I do think he understates the value here of Blackthorne when you think about the fact that he has rescued him more than once. Literally, physically rescued him, and how not in the context of this series, but historically, that cannon warfare and these better ships that will be built are going to be essential to his coming victory in this war. Yabu says, do you ever think about all the actions, all these lesser men who had to die for your vision, so pointless? And Torinaga quotes Blackthorne, unless I win. So only pointless if he loses. And all of this for his own ego, his own desire to be shogun. And he says it's for the greater good. But then in how many ways, Yabu says it right here, you're no better than us in your aspirations. And once again, Blackthorne, with his, I'm going to take my destiny into my own hands. Perhaps all three of these characters have all been driven by their own egos, just some more successful than others, just some more ambitious than others, just some more clever at hiding their true hearts. Torinaga says something very important here as well. When Yabu says, how impressive it must be to be someone like you who can shape the wind. And Torinaga says, I don't shape the wind. I simply study it. And this goes back to the idea, if you think about the wind, if you think about how birds glide on the wind, he doesn't control the birds. He doesn't control the wind. He simply studies it and uses its patterns to his will. So if bad things are going to happen anyway, why not happen in a way that benefits me? And this is thematically also what was explored in Dune 2, if you've seen that. Also part of the moral quandary about power and wielding it, that it gets explored in that excellent film adaptation. Dune definitely influenced, by the way, on James Clavell's novel Shogun as well. And then as we get to the end of the series, Blackthorne and Fuji are on a ship together. She's decided to become a nun, and he has offered to row her to the town across this bay. On the way, he suggests that she spill her son and husband's ashes so they can live together forever in the ocean, in the sea. And she obliges, and he does the same with Mariko's crucifix. So yet another very touching reference back to his love for her. She had given him the crucifix despite his lack of faith. And at her lowest moment, during a flashback, we saw that she received the crucifix from the same father who, in this episode, had spared Blackthorne's life. And he told her something to hold on to when there's nothing else. And that's exactly what she did. It's a fascinating moment because you think about the fact that this faith, this Catholic faith that she had dedicated herself to, was simply the branch that was held out to her at that moment, at her lowest point. And here he is again, similarly hanging on to these rosary beads. And if I read this correctly, he's holding rosary beads in the flash forward or the framing device of this episode. Does that mean that he converted at some point? Later, back on the beach, he's trying to get all the townsfolks to help dredge his ship out from the bay, and Buntaro arrives to assist. And they have some understanding between them. And eventually they raise the ship while Torinaga surveys his new realm, which eventually would encompass all of Japan. The end. As I mentioned, some differences in the book versus the series. Mostly it is significantly shortened. Most of the key events are almost identical. Some of the deaths very intelligently are focused on more key characters within the series, making them more impactful. Mariko's given much more agency in being much more involved in the decisions that lead to her fate. And the ending, there's a short epilogue in which we hear of the battle with Ishido, which we only see here briefly in Torinaga's envisioning of it. And he does die at the end of that. As I mentioned before, buried up to his neck and left to die. But for the most part, pretty faithful to the novel. And that battle in the novel takes place around 1603, which, not coincidentally, in actual history, is the beginning of the Edo period in Japan. Okay, so who are these characters in true historical context? Torinaga is Tokugawa Ieyasu, who has a nearly identical biography. He was captured and traded as a prisoner in his youth, got to know a lot of these other regents in the area, was known as a really brilliant strategist. As a matter of fact, at one point, in defeat, surrendered his hometown and retreated into the mountains, and then out of sight of the major lords, slowly built strategic partnerships until he eventually became the largest controller of land in Japan, which is reflected in some of the conversations here as well. Historically, there's a saying that he won by retreating, but once again, even historically known as someone who knew how to take an opportunity, knew how to see the way that the tides were turning, for example, and riding that to one victory after another. He did indeed win his first victory when he was 15 years old and had a relationship with William Adams, known as Myuran Anjin, who arrived by ship and was somewhat key to some of his sea victories later during his rise to shogun. So William Adams, once again, very similar to what we see in the film here, not the romance, which of course is very key to this story. And that's why you fictionalize things, so you can have these different character motivations and histories. But William Adams also arrived in a fleet of ships, originally five strong. By the time he arrives at Japan, only one ship remains. The crew is a skeleton crew at that point. Slightly differently than what we see here, most of the crew was allowed to return to the Netherlands to open up trade with the Japanese. Adams was left behind with the first mate of the ship. The captain had not survived. He was indeed their pilot, their engine. And he tried to leave multiple times, was given more and more rewards, land, a salary, and for years was not allowed to leave Japan. As a matter of fact, never left Japan, died in Japan. And he did build a small fleet of ships, which were used by Tokugawa to win several large battles, which led to, of course, to his shogunate. There was a council of the five regions, truly, historically. Ishida, Mitsunari is the corollary for Ishido. There was this political machinations. There was mistrust that Tokugawa was trying to wrest control over the area. This council of regents had been set up because the Taiko had died and his son was underage. The corollary to Lady Ochiba is Yorodano, who with her young heir did indeed try to prevent the rise of Tokugawa. So a little bit different here that she did not really step aside to allow the rise of Tokugawa. And lastly, very importantly, of course, is the corollary for Todomariko, who is Hosokawa Garcia, who was known in the area, had a very honorable reputation, and was also abused by her husband, and would actually walk around the village with her soiled and bloodied clothing as a way to shame him for his acts, to the point where eventually he begged her forgiveness. She was indeed held hostage, and during her abduction, she died, which did trigger a backlash among the other noble people. There was an explosion, and there's a question as to whether she chose to die or whether she was killed by one of her guards to prevent her from being kidnapped. But in popular culture, given her character, this is seen as a heroic act that she died for the purpose of revealing the hypocrisy of her captor. So historically, a lot of these events actually happened. Carville, of course, changes these things around to allow him to manipulate the events as he sees fit to put in some of this political intrigue, the motivations of the characters. But in terms of the big historical beats, it's actually very close to what happened. But I do want to talk about the Edo period itself. After Tokugawa takes control and has this final shogunate in Japan, this era lasts for over 200 years. As I mentioned in my recommendations all the way at the beginning, those films span 1613 all the way to 1860 or something like that, a 250-year period, which popularly is considered this extremely peaceful, idyllic period historically, a very Camelot-like fantasy of what the reality was, when even though there was this fantasy that the shogunate would lead to this harmonious ruling of the land and a reduction in all these wars, the reality is in the historic record that there were so many different power plays, maybe not among the warlords, not among these different regions, but among the emperor and the shogun. So the shogun had the actual power and the emperor was more of the, historically, the figurehead of the country. But over the course of this long period of time, there were multiple different attempts at a coup within the shogunate, within these powerful families, within other power structures, whether they be bureaucracies, whether they be the emperor's army, whether they be political forces, whether they be religious forces. I forgot to mention that something that also correlates to the series here is that during the Edo period, the Christians were forced out of the country. They were seen as a threat to the shogunate. And William Adams, the Blackthorn corollary, his skepticism around the Catholic Church definitely had something to do with that as well. But for hundreds of years, Catholics were not allowed in the country. And here's where I mentioned that there's some kind of subtext here, potentially, that the historical document brings to the series. Yabu accuses Torinaga that what he really wanted was this all along. This was a secret heart. And all these lower men get to die so that you get what you want. And you are as petty as we are. But Torinaga has this fantasy that this will be a peaceful time, that the shogun will put an end to all these wars. And maybe he honestly believes that. Or maybe he just uses it as a convenient excuse. Obviously, we see that other people believe it. They actually say it to him over the course of the series. But what the history shows is that even in the mythology of the Edo period, there was still much violence. There was criminal gangs. There were feudal lords that continued to wield their power secretly or overtly. There were conspiracies among the reigning class. So it was not as peaceful a time as you would expect. And once again, go back to some of those recommendations. Some of that mythology is deconstructed within a lot of the films, the samurai films that we see that emerged, that document some of the this historical time period, sometimes factually, sometimes fantastically. But all that is to say that there is a slightly darker read when you bring in that additional context to this current show, that Have we been rooting for the bad guy the whole time? Once again, I will make a correlation to Dune 2. When you leave the theater at the end of Dune 2, you ask yourself, have I been rooting for this bad guy the whole entire time? And to a large extent, we have the same experience here in watching this series. So I did revisit the very first episode in preparing for this, and I do highly recommend that. So much of what plays out at the end of the show or is laid out over the course of the series is laid out in that very first episode, even when we're introduced to each one of those characters. So do revisit the pilot episode, a really strong episode, and really just shows how well-written this thing was from beginning to end. And I am sure that people will be talking about this show for the rest of the year. It will get many, many awards next year. And as I mentioned, this is an interesting examination of political intrigue and the corrupting force of power that correlates directly to other things that are in popular culture right now, the upcoming House of the Dragon, which we will be covering here on the podcast, and of course, Dune 2, which is still playing in theaters and now available to rent at home, which is also truly excellent. Okay, so upcoming, I have recorded that gentleman / Guy Ritchie recommendation episode. It will probably be published this week. It's been waiting in the chamber because there's so many other things coming out right now. And it ended up being relatively light, so I also have some horror movies that I've been watching recently. Wanted to do like a little roundup of horror movies. There's been a lot of them, not so great so far this year, but I have some thoughts on some of them. Maybe that'll all be in one episode, maybe separate episodes. And on the upcoming TV front, I'll be checking in with Sona on the new FX spy thriller, The Veil, next week. We may check in again with the series Under the Bridge. I've been watching a very strange series on Apple TV Plus called Sugar with Colin Farrell, and I have many things to say about that show. The Sympathizer on HBO, The Jinx also on HBO, all things that we will be discussing here on the podcast in the next couple of weeks. So stay tuned for all of that. I hope you enjoyed Shogun, and I'll talk to you soon.